Hey, this is our 35th week now, and so we are well into this book and into Bible history. This last week, you were to be reading pages 471 through 486. We have a major portion of the Proverbs in the early going, and then some six chapters out of 1 Kings that are discussing the life of Solomon in a particularly busy period, you know, that time in which he is building. So, as I've grown fond of doing each week, over a month and a half, I think now, I try to remember these dates. What happened in 1050? Saul became king. How long did he reign? 40 years. Who takes over after him? David. And our year then is 1010. You will have been noticing, by the way, that for all of the questions that can arise about biblical dating, usually of a rather insignificant nature, a matter of just a few years, sometimes as much as a 200-year period where we're not sure when a particular event took place. But you will have found in the course of the reading this week, and I think the last couple of weeks, but at least twice in this week, that there's a general agreement about this time frame. So who became king in 970? Solomon did. And in the reading this week, as a matter of fact, what did he do 4 years later? What would 4 years later be? 966. In 966, what does Solomon do? He begins building the temple. How long is it going to take him to do it? 7 years. He's going to invest a vast amount of wealth. He is going to mobilize an army of laborers. He is going to be involved in an international engineering and transportation problem. And 7 years later, he will succeed in creating and building according to God's plans as delivered to his father David and handed off to Solomon, the first temple. That temple that will be the residing place, the resting place, and the ruling place of our God on earth. Well, Solomon himself will point out in his prayer that God cannot be contained in a building, yet these people are graced with the presence of God in a unique and special sense, vested in the temple in Jerusalem, beginning in the 7 years, starts with 966. Who, by the way, is Solomon's son? Rehoboam. He will take over the reins at 930. So I put him on the board there, but this is not dealing with the length of his reign. 930 is just the start of his reign. So this entire period of time right here, from 1050 to 930, would be how many years? It's 120 years. It's easy. It's divided into three 40-year spans, which each of the men reign for 40 years. We refer to those 120 years as the what? The United Kingdom. These 120 years will be the only years where you have one king over all 12 tribes in which everybody is getting along, and you have then a United Kingdom. These are good years, but most of them, Saul's are, you know, quite a few not so great. So we then say, in the 40 years that comprises David and Solomon's reign, what do we refer to those two reigns, those 80 years as? Those 80 years are the golden age of Israel. They're just never going to have a better time. In both cases, they have wise men, they have righteous men, they have courageous men, they have a father and a son who are utterly devoted to their God. And so in all of your studies of the Old Testament, this is, you know, just everybody's favorite time, I guess, or certainly one of them. Not a lot of wars going on, so we don't have to read the ugliness of all of that. We have the wisdom literature that Solomon is producing for us, which is always so very encouraging. Prior to that, you know, we saw a lot of bloodshed in David's life, of course, but we also saw many examples of how to conduct our affairs daily, as well as having, of course, the Psalms to give us such great encouragement. So in these 80 years, you have the golden age of Israel. You have just such a wonderful period of time. If you had to pick a time to live in the Old Testament, this would be it. This would be it for sure. So, that being the case, now we've got ourselves, you know, planted there. You remember this chart from last week. God considers these years so important and these two men so tremendously important that 11% of the entire Bible is dedicated to David and an additional 5% is devoted to Solomon. So 68 chapters of our Bible we're going to be reading over the course of several weeks, about 6 weeks altogether, you know, that are all revolving now, 68 chapters around Solomon. Yeah, at the rate, risk of great personal injury, even though it is my birthday, I'm going to start tonight by skipping over the Proverbs, starting with chapter 17, running down about 21 or 22, I forget. We'll hopefully have some time at the end of the class to come back and look at some of the Proverbs. But you're familiar with them. I taught them here 3 years ago. You know that each one is a standalone thing. The nature of the material, you know, is hard to do kind of an overview on anyway. Whereas the significance for the next 379 years in Solomon's building this temple is of such towering importance that I thought tonight we'd skip over the Proverbs that he had written. We'll go to these passages, six chapters, 1 Kings 5 through 10 first. Now hopefully we'll be able to get through that, you know, and go back and look at some of the Proverbs, but I wanted to focus on that at the outset today. So let's look at the building project, starting with page 476. So 5 pages deep into the reading then this week. Everybody come on over to page 476. And there at the very bottom right-hand column, you'll find the beginning of 1 Kings 5. And let's read that. It's still over on the next page, first 12 verses of 1 Kings 5. Hiram, king of Tyre, sent his servants to Solomon because he heard that they had anointed him king in place of his father. For Hiram had always loved David. Hiram had loved David. Hiram is a king in Tyre. Is Hiram a Jew? No. David has conducted his affairs so well that even those that were sort of the natural enemies of the Jews, in this case, immediate to the north border in the country we now would call Lebanon, this man, the city of Tyre, is a king who loved David. And with the death of David, when he finds out that Solomon becomes king, he immediately wants to send his ambassadors. He wants to make contact. He wants to continue that relationship. And so he sent his ambassadors. And there in verse 2, Solomon sent to Hiram. So he got the message from Hiram. Now he's returning a favor. And he says, Solomon does, "You know how my father David could not build a house for the name of the Lord his God, because of the wars which were fought against him on every side, until the Lord put his foes under the soles of his feet. But now the Lord my God has given me rest on every side. There's neither adversary nor evil occurrence. And behold, I propose to build a house for the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord spoke to my father David, saying, your son, whom I will set on your throne in your place, he shall build the house for my name. Now, therefore, command that they cut down cedars for me from Lebanon, and my servants will be with your servants, and I will pay you wages for your servants according to whatever you say. For you know, there is none among us who has skill to cut timber like the Sidonians." Okay, so the country is Sidon, the Sidonians. The city is Tyre. This is where King Hiram is living. The country is what we call Lebanon today. And there, to the eastern side of this little country, much smaller than Israel, but you know, at the time, but there to the east, rising up on the hills, are the world-famous, to this day, cedars of Lebanon. And so now Solomon has had these plans for some time. He knows exactly what's to be done. And as it was so long ago, it is to this day. Cedar is a favorite finishing material. It's beautiful. It smells good. It resists the bugs even. You know, it is in every way just an ideal kind of a building material. And at the time, the country to the north of Solomon is renowned for these cedars. So he wants to establish a treaty with Hiram. He wants to continue the goodwill that his father had. And he wants to immediately start paying this Gentile king for his skillful laborers. They're the men most familiar with this material, but also, you know, who will be cutting it down and transporting it. And so it was, as you continue the reading there at verse 7, when Hiram heard the words of Solomon, he rejoiced, and he didn't just rejoice, he rejoiced how? What's the adverb?
Greatly.
This man is just elated. He is thrilled to hear this. And so he said, blessed be the Lord. Now, if you're here last Sunday night, and you're looking at the word Lord there, and you've seen it several times as Solomon was writing this letter to King Hiram, that Lord, L-O-R-D, is printed in what kind of letters? All capitals, which indicates what Hebrew word that appears 6,000 times in your Old Testament? Yahweh, which is the personal name of God. And it's derived from a root that just has to do with being. So that, it is, I am. And even speaking to Moses, and again on other occasions, I am that I am is the one true and living God. So every time you see Lord in all capital letters, you know it is that word, the personal name. And Solomon is, you know, not the least bit hesitant to say to this king, whose God is not Yahweh, that Solomon is building a temple to Yahweh, not any other Gentile God, and we have our relationships and all that, but the temple is to my God. He's given David a wise son over his people. So Hiram sent in verse 8 to Solomon saying, I've considered the message which you sent me. I'll do all you desire concerning the cedar and cypress logs. My servants shall bring them down from Lebanon to the sea. I will float them in rafts by sea to the place you indicate to me, and will have them broken apart there. Then you can take them away, and you shall fulfill my desire by giving food for my household. Then Hiram gave Solomon cedar and cypress logs according to all his desire, and Solomon gave Hiram 20,000 cores of wheat as food for his household and 20 cores of pressed oil, and thus Solomon gave to Hiram year by year. So the Lord gave Solomon wisdom as he had promised, and there was peace between Hiram and Solomon, and the two of them made a treaty together. Would that we could still do that today all across the surface of the earth, where people, whether they worship the same God or not, whether they've had, you know, past historical problems or whatever, would find wise kings who could figure out how to get along together and mutually benefit from the trade that now results in is all of it involving and great expense there. And I don't know how to translate these amounts into modern dollars. Modern dollars keep changing every day anyway. That's why I'm not a day trader on the market. but it's a lot. And the king, of course, is well pleased with it. So the treaty is established or maybe continued. And so I want to take a few minutes, though, and we do go back to the maps here and look at some that you haven't seen before. We're going to start at our farthest distance out to begin with here and try to get the setting again. This is the golden age of Israel. It will have its largest influence in the world. It's going to be trading throughout the world. Solomon's ships are going to be sent out just everywhere, caravans as well. So on this particular map, the modern-day map, got the modern you know, names on them. Here's the Saudi Arabian Peninsula down here in the very south. Here's this enormous country of Iran right here today. Iraq, about half that size. They've been at war with each other, you know, for just the longest time. And then, of course, we've got Syria, which it has Damascus in it, and Paul was converted on the road there. Here's Jordan, modern Jordan today, essentially just everything to the east of the Jordan River. Of course, you've got the Sinai Peninsula. Here's Egypt, Lydia doesn't fit here in Bible stories. But all of Turkey and through Greece and into Italy, of course, once we get into our New Testament, we're going to have Paul and his missionary journey. But essentially what you're looking at right here, the vast body of this right here, is all your Bible history. It's going to take place there. It's not going to take place in South America. It's not going to take place in North America. Not in Australia. You know, it's not in Russia. It's here in this region. So once you get it fixed, I want you to take note now of this body of water and this body of water and this big body of water right here. Y'all know the Mediterranean Sea and the boot of Italy. This is Mediterranean, this is Black Sea, this is Caspian Sea, this is what we refer to as the Persian Gulf, this is the Red Sea. And now I'm going to draw this square. We're going to zoom in on a different map into this smaller area, be a little bit more specific here for just a minute. This is a Bible software program I bought some years ago. You can get it online, as a matter of fact, for free. Wouldn't it be nice if I could remember its name now? GLOW. It's called GLOW. G-L-O. Just G-L-O. You can go online and look for this. I went ahead and sprang, you know, for the much more expensive full one, but if you go online, you can find the GLOW Bible, G-L-O Bible. It's really amazing. It has some excellent maps. You can zoom into any degree that you want. They're just covered. All these little spots that you'll be seeing more of are links that you can click on for photographs and other information. It's like a kind of living map-oriented encyclopedia of all things biblical. So I really highly recommend it, for your own Bible studies at home. But what we have here now are the biblical names that are assigned to that region. So here we got those bodies of water, Caspian, Black Sea, Mediterranean, Red Sea, that we were talking about earlier. And Medo-Persia, Media and Persia, is in modern-day Iran. Kuwait's this little bit right down here, it's labeled Chaldea, but you have in here Babylon, Assyria, Nineveh. These are countries, of course, that will figure enormously in the history that is going to follow the immediate future after Solomon. 200 years after Solomon, we're going to be dealing with Assyria in very short order. And then, of course, you've got Israel actually over here, and you see a little bit closer detail of all these various cities that Paul's going to be getting into. Once again, I always use these red squares to highlight. We're going to zoom in on this same satellite photo now with the biblical names superimposed. So here's our Red Sea, the Sinai Peninsula. We have Midian, where Moses spent so much time, 40 years, Arabia down here in the lower corner. And then Lebanon in the far north up here. Galilee is this region. That's the Sea of Galilee. Tyre and Sidon are right in here. So this area right here where Hiram is living, and he's going to be shipping all this cedar. But I want you, especially at this level, we're going to zoom in one more time, you know, take note of this Gulf of Aqaba right here, which is leading down into the Red Sea. This is the Gulf of Suez. This is the Gulf of Aqaba. They form the borders for this triangulation that creates the Sinai Peninsula. Israel proper in Bible times is from Dan to Beersheba. How often we heard that phrase. But as I pointed out here last class, there's this pie shape down here that comes right to the corner there, very sharp angle to that corner. And in Solomon's time, his territory reached all the way down to that water. And Israel does to this day. This southern region is very desolate. It's referred to as the Negev, which is a word that means south. But as we zoom in, I guess we're not zooming in any closer than this, you will have been reading about Hiram's ships that Solomon is running out of that port right there, Eleth or Ezion-Geber. And this is really kind of an amazing thing. Apparently, as a part of this treaty, Solomon and Hiram agreed that they were going to have ships that were apparently built by Hiram. He's the better master woodworker, and particularly when it comes to the Mediterranean Sea, he's more focused on that kind of trade. Israel was not so much a sailing country. They weren't like the Phoenicians. They weren't like the Sidonians. They weren't invested in boats and trying to do trade out on the sea like that themselves. So Solomon got together with Hiram, and not only will they have these cedars coming in from here, but ships are going to be built together mutually and operated by Solomon out of here so that he has access the vast riches of the world from that little port down there outside the Mediterranean Sea. Now we zoom in back to the map we looked at last time. And here's our Sea of Galilee. Hazor is one of these green symbols that represents one of the five major fortifications that Solomon built. So we've been reading about those already. Megiddo is the second, the third's in Beth Horon, Gezer and Beth Shemesh. Those are the five that you read about. Hazor and Megiddo to this day have been excavated extensively. Every word that's ever said in the Bible about Solomon and his building project, you can find, you know, today at your feet and touch with your hands. There are those two locations. But this dotted line right here represents Tyre, where from King Hiram and Tyre, we have them going up to fell all the cedars of Lebanon up here, coming back down in making rafts out of those cedars, and flowing them all the way down the coast in here to another little fortified location, where Solomon then would break up the rafts and take everything over here to Jerusalem to do the building. The reason I go through all of this, brethren, is to show that this is really the first time in world history where the world is getting involved in Israel. Everything about them has been really pretty local. They track those slaves down in Egypt, you know. They make their way over to start their own new nation over there. But they're a tiny little country, 150 miles from Dan and Beersheba. And so, you know, very localized, very, very small kind of a thing. By the time you get to Solomon, Solomon is one of the wealthiest people on the planet. Solomon's making international treaties. Solomon is getting involved in shipping to the far south in the Gulf of Aqaba. Solomon is sending out caravans everywhere. Solomon is becoming tremendously wealthy and tremendously influential. And of course, then as we go down on throughout human history, Jesus the Christ will come to fulfill all of the Mosaic law. Jesus, of course, will live and die in the vicinity around Jerusalem. And eventually his influence will transcend even that, you know, the mercantile influence of Solomon to become spiritual ruler of the earth. So, let's go now to page 477 and just continue our reading in 1 Kings 5 at verses 13 now through 16. Then King Solomon raised up a labor force out of all Israel. The labor force was 30,000 men. And he sent them to Lebanon, 10,000 a month, in ships. They were 1 month in Lebanon and 2 months at home. Adoniram was in charge of the labor force. Solomon had 70,000 who carried burdens, that's an additional 70,000, and 80,000 who quarried stone in the mountains, besides 3,300 from the chiefs of Solomon's deputies who supervised the people who labored in the work. So what's the grand total here on the slide? 183,300 men. Is that a lot?
Yeah.
That's a lot. And 30,000 of them were designated to do a shift 1 month at a time, a rotating basis. Took 7 years. So each one of those three shifts is going to be up there 4 times a year, and they're going to go 7 years. They're going to spend a lot of time up in Lebanon, working with these Lebanese, we would say, but Sidonian at the time, laborers. And they're sharing their meals together. They're working together. They're cutting trees together. It's an amazing thing that's going on right here. Under, of course, God's oversight, these Jews are not so isolated that they are supposed to be God's chosen people, singled out from all the rest of the world, and hiding behind giant walls where nobody can ever say hi. They're not that. They're never intended to be that. They're very influential worldwide, and they're interacting on a daily basis for the next 7 years closely in this ginormous building project. Now, through the years, I found a couple of different sources to give us an idea about these quarrymen that we were just reading about. So if you look at the screen here, the quarriers that we just read first would drive metal spikes into crevices in the stone. Those spikes then, once they got them driven down in there, they then work them back out again, and they would ram wooden pegs down into the holes and into the crevices that they had created. So, now that they've got the wooden wedges in there, and all in a nice line, see how he's on the edge of the cliff right here, so he's driving some vertically, they've been driving some horizontally as well. The next step is to keep water poured on this wood at all times. What then happens? The wood swells, these cracks then will develop, and they'll be able to pop out these very large stones, but they're quite rough. And so, those blocks then are further shaped, first with chisels and adzes, and then with the level and the plumb rule and a square and a line, make diagonal measurements equal, and then finally smoothing it with this loaf-like rubbing stone that you see right here. When they get done, those blocks are so perfectly created. Their corners are so perfectly at 90 degrees. Their surfaces are so perfectly flat that they're going to be able to take these blocks, haul them on up to Jerusalem, or wherever the quarry is, however far they have to go, but, you know, then stack them into place and everything fits. Now here's a second source who had a different illustration of this. He's suggesting that as well as using these spikes we were talking about, that they had ways to carve channels, but exactly the same idea. And they would just split these blocks off and then go to work shaping them. And this particular picture is the third source that I found. I really liked it as a pencil sketch, just showing various other wooden devices with pulleys and all kinds of wheels and various things that they use, you know, to help them move what are, you know, blocks are tons heavy. Up to the location where this temple is going to be built. Now, I've just zoomed in on a previous one right there, but, you know, I'm sure there was a lot of this kind of stuff that was going on. Imagine men with their ropes, you know, and just doing it the hard way, dragging stuff along. But in Jerusalem today, there's an archaeological park that sits right next to the southwest corner of the Temple Mount. This is the wall of Jerusalem itself, and you're inside that wall. If you were to turn and look in that direction, you know, in the photo, you would see the Temple Mount rising up above you there, and you'd see the southwest corner. Don't tell anybody, but Farrell Jenkins and I looked this way, and we looked that way, and then we jumped over the fence, and we ran out here, and we got on this list. Jump back over the fence again. You know, but I went through a little bit of a gyration there to get these photos for you. But what they've done here is to recreate, you can read in Josephus and 100 other places, you know, the kinds of tools that they created so that these massive blocks could be moved and lifted in place after all that shaping had taken place. And so this is a crane, you know, it's an old-style crane. You got your rope coming down here. You got a winch that the guys could turn, and then you can be lifting your stumps. But it was this thing here that, that's the same thing you were looking at a moment ago, but off to the right here, it was this thing right here that I particularly got jumped the fence and ran in there to try to get a picture of. I couldn't get a better location. Do you see what that is? Well, you say it's a wheel. What is the hub of the wheel? It's the stone that they'd cut out. And so, what, you know, we think of in that previous picture is a bunch of guys, you know, being the guys in the Wizard of Oz, you know, doing the labor like that and just doing a lot of grunting. But they were smart. They knew how to do it. And so, sure, with that little crane thing, you can lift one end of the block. You then build your wooden wheel around it. Then you go to the other end, you lift that end, and you build another wooden wheel. And you could have a block that was 40 feet long if you wanted. You could have a block that was 6 feet, you know, square. And then, how hard is it to move that? Well, that's a piece of cake, isn't it? You just got a wheel built around the stone, you just roll the stone. And so, all I'm trying to do this morning is to say, God wanted you to know about this building. God wanted you to appreciate it. He wanted to tell you about it in some way. He wanted to try and portray how massive a project that this was. It took 183,000 guys 7 years to build this temple.
And that's not because they're a bunch of idiots who can't figure out, you know, how to make a rock square. They're highly talented. They're very efficient. They build quite rapidly. If it takes 7 years, why? Because it is going to be astonishingly beautiful, astonishingly intricately built. And so let's spend a little bit of time now come to understand that part of it. Let's go to page 477 now. I'm going to be reading in chapter 6, verses 1 through 5. I'm going to skip around a little bit. Let's talk about the temple itself. Chapter 6, verse 1. Came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel. What year is that? Come on, what year did Solomon become king? 970, 4 years later, were B.C. years, 966. So in 966, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, he began to build the house of the Lord. Now the house which King Solomon built for the Lord, its length, was 60 cubits. What is a cubit? Okay, we always say 18 or 19 inches, but Ron's got it over here. Holds up his arm and says from here to there. From here to there on who?
The king.
On the king. So is that a very standard measure? No, not really, but it works out to be 18 or 19 inches, you know. And so a cubit would change every time you had a new king, we understand, but it was about the length of a man's forearm to fingertips. So just think 18 inches, that's the easiest way to do it, which is, of course, a foot and a half. Okay, its length is 60 cubits. How long is that? 90 feet. Its width is 20 cubits. How wide is that? 30 feet. Its height is 30 cubits. How high is it? 45 feet. The vestibule in front of the sanctuary of the house was 20 cubits long across the width, and the width of the vestibule extended 10 cubits from the front of the house. And he made for the house windows with beveled frames against the wall over on page 478, now verse 5, of the temple. He built chambers all around. Don't forget that. There's the temple, and then there's what's all around it. These chambers. Against the walls of the temple, all around the sanctuary and the inner sanctuary, thus he made side chambers all around it. Skip down to verse 7. And the temple, when it was being built, was built with stone finished at the quarry, so that no hammer or chisel or any iron tool was heard in the temple while it was being built. Isn't that awesome? Now, off-site and out of earshot, we're going to spend 7 years doing the work so that we can then move it and set it in place so precisely constructed that it just fits together. It was awesome. Now, skipping a page, it's on page 478, very bottom of the left-hand column, verse 14 through 22. So Solomon built the temple and finished it. He built the inside walls of the temple with cedar boards. The floor of the temple to the ceiling, he paneled the inside with wood, and he covered the floor of the temple with planks of cypress. Then he built the 20-cubit room at the rear of the temple, from floor to ceiling, with cedar boards. He built it inside as the inner sanctuary, as the most holy place. And in front of it, the temple sanctuary was 40 cubits long. The inside of the temple was cedar, covered with ornamental buds and open flowers, which are not, you know, fauna. No, that'd be flora. You know, they're made out of wood. They're carved. All was cedar. There was no stone to be seen. And he prepared the inner sanctuary inside the temple to set the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord there. The inner sanctuary was 20 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, 20 cubits high. He overlaid it with pure gold and overlaid the altar of cedar. So Solomon overlaid the inside of the temple with pure gold. He stretched gold chains across the front of the inner sanctuary and overlaid it with gold. The whole temple he overlaid with gold until he had finished all the temple. Also, he overlaid with gold the entire altar that was by the inner sanctuary. I don't think Donald Trump could have built that. Okay? Really don't. We are talking about a construction, a wonder of the ages. One of the wonders of the world. Now, you'll find a million of these, you know, online, various schematics of what the temple will have looked like. It's all, here's a, you know, just one of very many, but I've drawn the dimensions on for you now, calculating out from the cubits. It's 105 feet long overall if you count everything. 105 feet. Can any of you guys tell me how long is this room? Do you remember, those of you that were here in the building, you know, how, remember the dimensions? I guess that this room is about 60 feet. And so possibly the temple would have been as long as the entire building is. But I didn't think to measure it out. One of these days we'll have to do that. But it's 105 feet. Then it's 30 feet wide overall. It will be actually divided into two parts with a porch or an entry. The Holy of Holies is 30 feet wide, 30 feet long, and what? 30 feet tall as well. The main hall is 60 feet long by 30, and this entranceway open-air porch thing is 15 feet by 30. All right, and then Solomon's temple is 45 feet tall, and somehow, we're not sure exactly what it looked like, some suggest that these two pillars were set kind of inside this entranceway vestibule area. Others suggest that they were half round and were affixed to the face of that entryway. So you'll see different kinds of artist renditions there. Not sure myself. These guys in this particular sketch suggest, you know, that they're on the outside of a wall like this rather than trying to support it like you saw in the previous one. Well, I'm not sure. I never saw David's plinths. But, again, I like this particular artist's sketch because it gives you some idea of how ornate, how extremely talented the artisans are, how beautiful this work is. They spent 7 years finishing this thing. They didn't spend 7 years hauling rocks. It took 7 years altogether so that it could be overlaid in gold. It could be inscribed into that gold, various figures, and you could have then these carvings in wood as well, so that inside, outside, and every side, this was just a marvel to behold. On page 481, if you were to turn a couple of pages, you'd see this picture. I took it right off the page there. Now, I would suggest to you that I did some measurements of my own on the photograph, and it looks to me like this, the C as it is called, is a little bit too big here. I estimated that these guys were 6 feet tall, and if they are, then that is a little bit oversized. I then used them as my measuring device, you know, and came out at 18 feet, or at least I'm only been 15. But, you know, something like that for this giant container for the ceremonial waters that are going to be washed. Now, I want to introduce one more thing to you, which you read about also. They are called the Mekhonot, or the Mekhonot, M-E-K-H-O-N-O-T. To read off the slide now, Solomon's temple was composed of a porch, which was called the Ulam, two entrance columns named Yachin and Boaz, a sanctuary, which is the high hall, and a shrine, the Debir, which was approached in the reconstruction here by a ramp, but more probably it was approached by stairs. The four-horned altar stood just outside the courtyard. Please notice the horns on the altar as Lean Rittmeyer has drawn it. Lean Rittmeyer, L-E-E-N-R-I-T-M-E-Y-E-R, has invested his entire life in the study of the Temple Mount. He is an architect by trade, and with no comparison or peer, he is the best, I think, at producing
illustrations of what this temple would have looked like, as well as Herod's temple, to follow. And so I've become quite a fan of this guy, Lean. I bought a bunch of stuff from him. You can go on the website and look at what he does. But you should know about Lean Ritmeyer. He says he's an archaeologist as well as an architect. He's devoted his whole life, he's living in Jerusalem, you know, really knows what he's talking about. He's a guy that will help you visualize these times and places better than anybody else, in my estimation at least. So, these horns on this altar and the 10 mechonot, which are portable lavers, you carry water in a bucket on top, are important to us. About in the 100-year period of 1200 B.C. to 1100 B.C., this incense cart was built and has been found. It is made out of bronze. It was designed to have this flange at the top to contain incense for burning. It is not related directly to the Temple Mount or the times we're talking about here. It's about 200 years before Solomon even lived. But can you see, even though it's not a very good picture, how ornate it is? It has been, all of it, you know, carved or made out of bronze. This one is a little bit even more enlightening for us. This is a mechonot, a wheeled cart, very like the ones that would have stood in Solomon's courtyard. Slide says, elaborately decorated with palms and cherubim, and the priests may have used them for ritual ablution. This example comes from Cyprus, where they found this one. But it displays the cherubim and the palmette design. So the picture's a little bit better, but this is a mechonot. So we're reading about it. God wants you to know about these things. They were used daily in the temple service. And Solomon is establishing a temple and his service that will last for 379 years before Nebuchadnezzar will destroy the thing. But something very like this, right down to these winged creatures, is what Solomon had his craftsmen create. Now, this slide, I think, is particularly important to us. That small horned altar, this thing was found in Megiddo. It's one of the marvelous treasure trove of archaeological artifacts that have been discovered there. This is why we're so sure what the horns of an altar look like. Because we've found altars that have horns on them. So, for years, I used to think in terms, you know, a curved bullhorn or something like that. Not like that at all. They found actually quite a few of these now, and they all look very similar. These corners are raised like that. They are the horns of the altar. As a matter of fact, if you accidentally killed somebody before the Avenger of Blood could get to you, what were you going to do? You ran, so you got to one of those altars, and then what'd you do? You held on to the horns. As long as you're there, nobody can harm you. So you're going to get a fair trial. The small horned altar from Megiddo and the bronze shovels from Tel Dan, both in Solomon's territory, are probably very similar to the incense altar and the shovels that would have been used in Solomon's temple as well. So we have artifacts now that these were not dug up on site at the temple, but they're from the time period in the cities of Solomon. So, 3,000 years later, we've actually got artifacts that give us a very clear picture of what they would have been working with at that time. And of course, you've got the Ark of the Covenant that's in the Holy of Holies, you know, something like that. And that brings us to page 479. So let's read this transition now on page 479, building the king's palace. How long to build the temple? 7 years. Now, the construction of the temple was a 7-year process lasting 966 to 959. The palace complex, however, took longer to complete because it included several buildings south of the temple. The House of the Forest of Lebanon served as a treasury and an armory. We'll be reading about it in 1 Kings 10. You'll see it in Isaiah as well. Other buildings were the Hall of Pillars, the Hall of Judgment, and residences for Solomon and Pharaoh's daughter. The account in 1 Kings records the length of time it took Solomon to complete the temple and the palace. In addition to the 7 years of the temple construction were another 13 years for the palace. Thus, these two major projects covered a period of 20 years
which would be what percent of Solomon's entire reign? He spent 50% of his 40 years doing what? Building the temple and building the palace. And when he got done, brethren, there wasn't a king on earth that wasn't impressed. There wasn't a king or a queen anywhere that wouldn't stand in the presence of that thing and say, "Wow, wealthy as I am, I never saw anything like that." It was the preeminent wonder of the world. And why not? We are looking at the temple of Yahweh. And his king, hand chosen. Okay? Solomon, son of David. We are looking at the golden age of Israel. And we are looking at what it'll never be again. We're looking at what is now going to be its pinnacle, because from this point on, what's going to happen in Jewish history? Downhill into civil war, destruction and captivity because of their sin. So, they had it then, and they lost it all eventually. I did want to mention one thing because I just found this curious as an insight into Jew-Gentile relationships. On page 479, just the two verses in 1 Kings 7, 13 and 14. So, 1 Kings 7, 13. King Solomon sent and brought Huram, not Hiram, Huram from Tyre. He was the son of a widow from the what? So, she is a Jew. He was the son of a widow. The widow was from the tribe of Naphtali. His father was a man of Tyre, a bronze worker. He was filled with wisdom and understanding and skill and worked with all kinds of bronze work. Well, wait a minute. Wait a minute. If the guy's old enough to be highly skilled as this type of worker in 966, then he must have been born, well, at least probably 20 or 30 years earlier, and that's well back into David's reign. And he is the child of a Jewish mother and a what? Of a Gentile up in Tyre. That's an interesting little insight, because it tells us that not only was David and Hiram so closely knit together that apparently, you know, they loved each other and they traded with each other, but we now have recorded at least one instance where the Jews were doing what with that Gentile nation? They were also intermarrying. Should they have been doing that? No, but they were. It had always been a problem. And oddly enough, as we find it several times, and we think God would be unhappy with this circumstance, Solomon looks out there and he finds this guy and he says, "Well, he's just the best, and so what are we going to do? We're going to hire him, bring him on down here, and have him work for us." Okay? So these craftsmen are kind of crossing, you know, the national border lines as well. Page 482 and 483 will bring us now this in last section. Very quickly, over Solomon's prayer and Solomon's blessing. With regard to Solomon's prayer, brethren, I just want to read a couple of verses on 482, and we'll start on 1 Kings 8, it is, at verse 22, which is right in the middle of that left-hand column. Solomon stood before the altar of the Lord in the presence of all the assembly of Israel, and he spread out his hands toward heaven, and he said, "Lord God of Israel, there is no God in heaven." What was the first word in Hebrew that he uttered? He said, "Yahweh, God of Israel, there is no God in heaven above or on earth below like you, who keep your covenant and mercy with your servants who walk before you with all their hearts." Now, you just have to do a bunch of skipping. I went and did the highlighting, so it's easy for me. You probably won't even be able to follow it very easily. But in the right-hand column, try to find verse 30. In a paragraph arrangement, I know that's hard to do, but it's in that first full paragraph at the top. "You may hear the supplication of your servant, Solomon's prayer continues, of your people Israel, when they pray towards this place, hear in heaven your dwelling place, and when you hear, forgive. And then his prayer goes on and on and on and on and on, and it's about only one thing. Forgiveness. In verse 31, when anyone sins against his neighbor, and you skip to 32, hear in heaven and act and judge your servants, condemning the wicked, bringing his way on his head, and justifying the righteous by giving him according to his righteousness. 33, when your people Israel are defeated before an enemy, then, skipping to 34, hear in heaven and forgive the sin of your people Israel. Bring them back to the land. 35, when the heavens are shut up, there's no rain. Skip way down to verse 39. Hear in heaven your dwelling place and forgive. Excuse me, and act and give to everyone according to all his ways. When Solomon builds the temple, he now wants to pray to his God in its dedication. He stands before the temple, he raises up his hands to heaven, and what does he over and over and over again pray that God will do for all the years to come? Forgive us, Lord, we are bound in sin. Forgive us when we do this, forgive us when we do that, forgive us when that happens, forgive us when this happens. I can see it coming. Forgiveness. Now, by the way, brethren, what is this whole temple all about? What is this holiest thing inside?
Forgiveness.
What is this holiest thing called? The mercy seat. Okay? That's what it's about. It is the place where the sacrifices will be offered. It is the place where the blood will be spilled for atonement, for forgiveness. Solomon is a wise man and he understands that. So what is it all about? His prayer. Forgiveness. Then we come to his blessing. The blessing begins on 483 in chapter 8, way on down, at verse 54. So it was when Solomon had finished praying all this prayer and supplication to the Lord. He arose from before the altar of the Lord, from kneeling on his knees with his hands spread up to heaven. Then he stood and blessed all the assembly of Israel with a loud voice, saying, Blessed be the Lord, who has given rest to his people Israel according to all that he promised. There has not failed one word of all his good promise, which he promised through his servant Moses. What is this moment in Jewish history? Well, there's a promise about a land. Have they had the land? Several hundred years. But there are other promises. Those promises, beginning with Genesis 12 and Abraham, are repeated in chapter 13, 15, and 17 to Abraham over and over again, repeated to his sons after that. They are now, all of them starting in Moses, is what he's specifically referencing, all of them are coming to fruition and culmination in a single day in which what is done? The temple is dedicated. This is the fullness of the Jewish religion. This is the pinnacle of its development. This is the glory of what God always wanted for those people. And from Moses, he had taken them from slavery of centuries across a wilderness and 40 years of death until finally they could live for hundreds of years in a land flowing with milk and honey until at long last Solomon could first kneel and then stand before this temple and say, here is where Yahweh lives, and we are his people. Now, with regard to Solomon's wealth, I am not going to read it. But on page 485, you will have already done it this week, for the sake of those listening on the tape, we're going to look at, not now, but read, chapter 10, verses 14 through 29, that don't have chronological, read chapter 10, 14 through 29. You get this long list of Solomon's wealth, which is simply is to say, staggering and unparalleled. Now, in the 1 minute I've got left, I want everybody to turn back to page 472. We're going to have, excuse me, time for just one proverb out of all these proverbs tonight. But I picked a couple, knowing I'd be running short of time. I got to pick one, and I did, and I am. Okay. One, brethren, out of this reading, and maybe even out of the whole book of Proverbs. Okay? This is the one that I would pick as likely, if believed and practiced, the most useful in your life. It is on page 472. It's in the right-hand column. It's in Proverbs chapter 18, and it is verse 9. He who is slothful in his work is a brother to him who is a great destroyer. Now, brethren, as you look back on tonight's class, you think about 7 years of blood, sweat, and tears to build that temple. You think of the massive size of the stones. You think of the elbow grease it took to smooth them down to microscopic finish so they could be stacked one on the other and you wouldn't need a tool. Just put them there. You think of the complexity and the beauty and the intricacy, the exquisite nature of the carvings and the engravings and everything overlaid with gold. And then you imagine a lazy worker out there on the job. Who's his brother? The great destroyer. What does the proverb say? It says, don't you fool yourself. When you're half-hearted in your service to your God, you are destroyer. When you're negligent, when you're lazy, when you're just not fully devoted and doing the best you can, do not ever attempt to excuse that behavior. Because he who is slothful in his work is a brother to him who is a great destroyer. I can imagine, brethren, 7 years of 183,000 men who poured their hearts and souls into this. And when they were done, to the glory of Yahweh, the only true and living God. And for a while, they would continue to serve Him well. And then, they would become slothful.
Let us not follow that path.